How does the brain process emotions? How are emotional memories formed and stored in the brain? And how do they influence behavior, perception, and decision-making? How does music help us understand our emotions, memories, and the nature of consciousness?
Joseph Ledoux is the Henry and Lucy Moses Professor of Science at NYU and Director of the Emotional Brain Institute. His research primarily focuses on survival circuits, including their impacts on emotions, such as fear and anxiety. He has written a number of books in this field, including The Four Realms of Existence, A New Theory of Being Human. Ledoux is also the lead singer and songwriter of the band The Amygdaloids.
Joseph Ledoux, welcome to The Creative Process.
Thanks for having me.
So, I mean, your journey is pretty surprising turn. You were a child in Cajun country, passion for pop music, and now, of course, you're one of the most cited neuroscientists in the world. That's a pretty powerful leap from that. And along the way, you studied marketing and business. You know, what made you make that turn towards human consciousness?
Well, I was never really particularly interested in marketing and business. I just, you know, it was just something that my mother picked actually for me to do when I went to college. I was more interested in having, you know, going to parties and having a good time. So it didn't really matter to me what I was studying. And I got an undergraduate degree in business administration. And then I was working on a master's degree in marketing. And while doing the master's, I'd been doing more and more studies of psychology in terms of taking extra classes and so forth, because I thought that was relevant to marketing. My thing in marketing was more like consumer protection rather than, you know, making people buy stuff. It was the late 60s, and you know, it wasn't cool to like be pushing products on people, and you know, got more credit with your friends if you were like trying to protect consumers. So in the process, I took a class called Learning and Motivation. I thought that would be relevant to what I was doing, but it turned out the guy was studying rat brains and memory. And I didn't know you could study rat brains and memory, and I kind of fell in love with what he was doing. And from there, I decided I would change fields. I went to graduate school at Stony Brook out on Long Island. And there I met Mike Kasaniga, who was an expert on split brain patients. And that's where I became interested in the topic of consciousness.
Indeed. And this very interesting aspect, which I imagine most of your neuroscience colleagues didn't have, which is that your dad was a bull rider. Just tell us a little about your childhood, because that, I think, gives an interesting perspective that you would later bring into the field of neuroscience.
Well, yeah, so my father grew up during the Great Depression. He was a teenager. You know, you often hear people running away with the circus. Well, he ran away with the rodeo because there was nothing else to do. So he was riding bulls. I think he rode in 37 different states during the Depression, including Madison Square Garden and other, you know, popular places. And at some point, he injured his back when he was thrown off the bull, which is something that happens to every cowboy that rides bulls. They get thrown off at some point and get an injury and have to do something else. So my father moved back to our hometown, Eunice, Louisiana, what would be my hometown. He was obviously much younger then, to take over his father's meat market. And after the war, he met my mother. And then I was born in 1949, a long time ago. And as I grew old, a little older, he had chores for me to do in the meat market. One of them was to use my fingers to, I had small fingers because I was a little kid, to remove the bullets from the brain of the cow, because they were selling cow brains as a delicacy for certain customers that liked that. And obviously, they wanted to remove any bullet that was in there so that the people wouldn't be, you know, swallowing lead or anything like that. So that was I learned a little bit about the brain at that point. Not that it was, had any plan of becoming a brain scientist, but it was just interesting to, you know, you pulled and they just come apart, like they're just kind of sitting there and loosely connected, but one hemisphere comes off, the other hemisphere comes off, and then you're left kind of with a core of the brain stem down there that is not connected so much to the other parts. I mean, there are nerve pathways that go all the way through, but when you pull the two hemispheres off, the nerves get disconnected there. So yeah, I learned a little bit about anatomy, but never really kind of gave it much of a thought until in high school. I was taking biology class and I learned about what the different parts of the brain were called. And one that I was particularly fascinated with was the cerebellum, because it had such an interesting visual appearance. You know, it kind of sits down in the back on top of the brainstem. It's kind of like another little brain there, but it's really kind of much more wrinkly than the cerebral cortex. And by the time I got to college, I was one night with some friends, we put on a kind of air guitar. And I named the little group doing this cerebellum and the medullas after that part of the brain that I had liked the appearance of and then learned the name of in high school. And little did I know that someday in the future, I would also have a band named after a part of the brain. The band was called the Amygdaloids. And well, that's history.
I'm curious, obviously, fear is something that your father was dealing with, and you as a young boy dealing with it, very much having this encounter with death and it becoming like an automated thing. At the time, a lot of people thought that animals, they weren't sensitized. There were all these kind of assumptions that were made. Babies didn't feel pain, all these kind of strange things. How do you feel that went into your early awareness of the world and what would later become one of your defining theories?
I don't think it had much of an impact. It was, you know, just a passing event in young life. There were lots of things that passed through young life. You know, for example, I remember being probably, I don't know, 5 or 6 years old, and my father asked one of the people that worked in his store to take me fishing because, you know, I was off school or something. And so we went to the side of a bayou, and when we got there, it was covered with water moccasins. You know, the land around the bayou, just so many snakes. It was really terrifying. And I never got over that particular thing. I don't like snakes. There were snakes everywhere in Louisiana. But it was something, just some people just thought it was cute, but I just had a terrible fear of snakes. I finally got over it in later in life. I still don't like walking around in the woods too much without like good boots on or something.
Yeah, it makes me reflect on your theory about fear and how we receive it and how we store it. A lot of our fears now are, you know, existential, but they're like to do with climate change or existential threats.
Political fears.
Yes, we internalize them, but we can't necessarily see them. Although climate change is very real when it's coming right up, your house is flooded, fires, these kind of things are very real. But there's this kind of dread that we have now.
Yes, dread is, you know, an important part of life. The philosopher Kierkegaard said that anxiety was the price we pay for having freedom, the freedom to choose. You know, he was a very strongly Christian philosopher and was referring to the Garden of Eden. And according to, you know, his philosophical idea was that from Adam's choice, all of humans acquired this ability to choose. And, you know, another way to think about this, though, is that anxiety is certainly involved in the ability to choose, because we don't know what the outcomes will be when we make a decision. But another way to think about it is that our ability to anticipate the future, which is something our prefrontal cortex helps us do, is what allows us to have choices. So there's a scientific basis for the idea that choice is an important part of human existence.
So one of the ways that you overcome perhaps this dread, this anxiety that we all experience, or you explore your creative states and your consciousness, is through your music. You play the guitar, you write the lyrics.
Yes. You know, I also try, like if I'm anxious about something, I also try to meditate. I'm not an expert at all, but it's, you know, I find it useful to take those deep breaths and become internalized and try to shut out the things and try to reason through them in a calmer way. But what I found, and this is probably true of everyone, that the moments you need meditation most are the times it's hardest to do it. Because if you're very anxious, it's hard to get into that state. Once you're there, it's obviously very helpful.
And so your song Mind Over Matter, where did that come from?
Well, that song in particular, I think it's different from most of the other songs I've written, because it was about trying to reconnect with someone that you've lost in your life, either, you know, for whatever reason, a romance gone bad, or a loved one has died. And that song was about the death of my son. I don't want to go into a lot of details, but it was, you know, that kind of loss is really kind of what put me into music in a serious way, just because you're struggling to find some place, something that will help you cope with a loss like that. And for me, music was very helpful, and especially writing music, being able to compose things that helped me sort through what I was feeling and thinking.
Mind over matter, that's something I'm trying to do. It's just a little physics that keeps me apart from you. Mind over matter, that's something I'm trying to do. Break down space and time and be together with you. I'm trying to will you here, find you wherever you are, locate your body and soul, pull you in from afar. Are you still in my time, or have you slipped away? Have you gone forwards and back, living in another day? Where, oh, where might you be? Different continent or on the sea? In the air, flying free, or in a place heavenly. Wherever you are now, I'll use my mind to find. No amount of space or time can keep you from being mine.
And one other song that I wrote that we never recorded. There were really two songs that were about my son's death. And they were kind of a stepping stone, because before that happened, I was never able to write a song. I would try as a teenager, tried to write songs. I couldn't do it. Later in life, I tried. It never seemed to work. But something pulled me in and allowed me to find a way to do that because I needed to do it in that situation. And then I had some kind of template on which to build.
It's really something to emotionally work your way through when it's totally raw and personal, and then out of that to find reason and meaning. I'm sorry, I didn't know the origins of that song. I had always imagined that the stories behind your songs were more philosophical or concepts from neuroscience, you know, ways of explaining consciousness to us. I always imagined they came from a creative but a intellectual space.
Yes, you're right. Most of the songs are just more intellectual, about things I know about philosophy or neuroscience and behavior.
And I mean, talk about, you know, faith in a way. It seems like it's a conversation that you're having with your son, or maybe that could have been kind of a creative conversation that you imagine having. You talk about meditation, but what is your spiritual practice, or how do you connect with the mysterious?
Well, you know, as a scientist, I don't really go down the road of spiritual and mysterious. You know, science can be mysterious. I try to think of it as being mysterious in the way that, for example, the idea of the genetic basis of inheritance was mysterious before we had genes. You know, the biological basis of inheritance wasn't understood until Watson and Crick discovered DNA. And so that's where I go. I mean, but, you know, when I'm not wearing my scientific hat, you know, I treat my pets as if conscious and emotional as I am, even though I don't know exactly what's going on in their heads. You know, you can't be a scientist every moment of the day. And so, you know, in my quieter moments, I wouldn't say I have a kind of religious spirituality to it, but I explored that spiritual kind of part in Mind Over Matter, because I was saying, you know, I'm trying to will you here, find you wherever you are, break down space and time and be together with you again, something like that. So that was a kind of longing that was pulled out of me from grief. But most of my songs are happier and just in general, they're love songs about mind and brain and mental disorders. And that may sound weird, but most rock music is about mind and brain and mental disorders in one way or another. So it's just kind of part of the genre. And, you know, we created our own genre called heavy mental. And that was the title of a small piece that was written about the amygdaloid's first performance. And we loved the title so much, you know, heavy mental, that became our first album. And we've kind of kept that as our calling card, because I think we're the only heavy metal band there is. So if there's ever a Grammy for that, we should get it.
It's great to have no others in the category. But it's strange because I had never thought about music, most of it being about mind and brain and mental disorders. But I guess, you know, they're emotional. And yeah. So when you entered what at the time was a new field of neuroscience, the study of emotions was really unheard of. So tell us what that was like entering into that landscape.
So my first grant in 1985, the first grant I submitted to NIH, National Institute of Health, was rejected because neuroscientists don't study emotion. You know, it's like taboo. This was from the time when the behaviorists were still very dominant in psychology. And so things like consciousness and emotion being kind of a state of consciousness were not topics that you could get funding for and study. So the work I was doing involved Pavlovian conditioning as a way to study emotional behavior. And so I disguised myself as a Pavlovian conditioning researcher for the next few years till I kind of got some grounding in the field before I could actually begin to talk about emotion. And so then, you know, then I started writing about emotion and consciousness in my review papers or book chapters or even my books, because I could do whatever I wanted there. I didn't have to be peer reviewed for those.
Yeah, it seems so strange to me now. I mean, it's the needle has really moved that you could study the brain and consciousness and not think about emotions. And I think, you know, the arts tell us we're not really the logical creatures we think we are.
Yeah. Well, even today, you know, this thing called the scientific study of consciousness, which I was the president of last year. And The whole field was largely about how we become aware of visual stimuli. So like, are you conscious of that dot on the screen? There was nothing about memory in the field, nothing about emotion. And so I've been trying to introduce those topics so that the study of consciousness could be about something important rather than, I mean, it's not unimportant that we understand visual consciousness, but yeah, there are lots of more important things to pursue as well, like emotion and memory.
And I want to go into, because I've been tempted to ask about AI and what these discoveries are telling us. When we're outsourcing our memory, our creativity, and so much to that, like what is that doing to us, our consciousness, when we're depending on our AI co-creators so much. But on this point of your insights, what do you feel about how your discoveries may have been used by malign actors, social media companies, or traditional media companies where, you know, feeding users on a diet of fear and manufactured rage to engage? Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I have more problems with what happened within the field itself, because it's kind of a problem of be careful of what you wish for. So emotion really took off, and it took off in a way that was reminiscent of what was happening in the late 19th century that ultimately led to the behaviorist revolution that took over psychology and eliminated consciousness. Because at the time, in the late 19th century and early 20th century, consciousness was being called upon to explain everything a person, a human, or an animal was doing. And not everything we do consciously. And the behaviorists did a good thing there in the sense that they said, okay, we have to be more reasonable about what is controlling behavior. But they just went too far and eliminated everything, eliminated every kind of conscious state. And when we got emotion going again in the 1990s, the same thing happened where emotional consciousness was called upon to explain a lot of stuff that it wasn't necessarily being explained by that. There were two problems. One is that consciousness was being overused, but the other was that there were still a bunch of behaviorists lingering around, and they refused to think about emotion as consciousness. They thought about emotion as behavior. I was stuck between two kinds of camps. One where if you're freezing in danger, that means that your fear is what caused that. And I know that's a not very natural assumption that fear causes us to behave in a certain way. But what my work was suggesting was something different, that the conscious experience of emotion and the behavioral and physiological consequences happen in parallel, not in sequence. So for example, let's say a rat or a mouse is freezing to something dangerous. The question is the rat's fear causing it to freeze, or is there something else going on? I think there's something else going on. Let's just put it in terms of human fear, because we don't really know what goes on in the head of another animal. It's not to say there's nothing going on, but it's just much easier to talk in terms of humans. So when we are in danger and running away or freezing, that is happening because our brain, particularly for a brain area like the amygdala, has detected danger and has set us off on an innate pattern of defensive behavior to protect us. So it might cause you to freeze temporarily, or it might cause you to flee, run away, and so forth, or to fight back. So it'd be freeze, fight, flight kind of thing. These would be automatic responses that are innately programmed into the human brain. And that happens simultaneously with the fact that you also become afraid, with fear being more of a kind of cognitive interpretation of the situation in which you find yourself escaping or freezing. And so that is a perspective that I've had since the time I was doing the split brain research, because one of the things we discovered, if I could talk about split brains for a minute. So in a split brain patient, the connections between the two sides of the brain, the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere, are sectioned in an effort to control intractable epilepsy. Epilepsy is so bad that the medications that were available back in the 70s were insufficient to control the seizures. So I have no idea who figured this out or what was the basis for it. Neurosurgeons started doing this procedure in severe cases of epilepsy in an effort to help people. And it did have some beneficial effects. But the interesting thing was what was going on in these two sides of the brain that are no longer connected. So The left hemisphere is usually the side of the brain that does all the talking. The right hemisphere can see and respond behaviorally to stimuli that it sees, but can't talk about it. So we did this one study where we put two stimuli, one on the left side of space, one on the right side of space. Everything to the left side goes to your right hemisphere. Everything on the right side goes to your left hemisphere. So on the right side was a chicken claw. On the left side was a snow seam. So the left hand pointed to a shovel to go with the snow seam. The right hand pointed to a chicken to go with the chicken claw. So now we asked the left hemisphere, the one that can talk, what did you see? Or why did you do that? And he said, well, I saw a chicken claw, so I pointed to the chicken, and you need a shovel to clean out the chicken shed. Left hemisphere knew nothing about the snow seam, so we just put chicken and shovel together and said, okay, that's what it is. So it was an instantaneous narration that came out, observing that the left hand had performed a behavior that the left hemisphere didn't understand. So in order to compensate for that in some sense, it generated a narrative. The idea is that in the human brain, we have some capacity, some function that allows us to make sense of our behavior. We all believe we have some kind of, you know, free will and that we choose what we do. But there are lots of systems in the brain that control our behavior unconsciously, especially emotion systems that cause you to flee or freeze and so forth. But also, we aren't always in great control over our emotions. We might lash out at a partner in an argument. And so when these behaviors come out that we didn't necessarily intend or plan, we have a capacity to try to explain that, which is to generate a narration, a story that makes what we did make sense. So let's say you're having an argument with your partner and you do say something awful to the other person. The narration that you might have at that moment was he or she deserved it, so I'm not taking it back. I've done this, but I'm not taking it back. Or it could be that, oh, I'm sorry, I should not have said that. That was the wrong thing. If you stick with the person deserves what I said, by the next day, you have to re-narrate that at some point in your relationship to maintain the relationship. So it's all about these narrations, whether they're done on the spot or later. We always have to have a way to account for the behaviors that we produce non-consciously. And that's what this amazing mechanism is that tells a story. Now, the stories are not always accurate, but they are stories that keep the kind of unity of consciousness together, the unity of mind. So it allows us to think of ourselves as a whole system that even when we don't produce a behavior intentionally, we have an explanation for why we did that. Otherwise, we would be confused about what we were doing.
Yeah, that point where we are the stories we tell ourselves, and we have to also question the stories we've always told ourselves that may lie deep back in our cultural memory, the language, how that imprints upon how we, you know, different hierarchies and how we perceive the world. And I know that you grew up around French, but you didn't learn French. But, you know, when you're born into different languages, we can look at the world with, I say, greater humility. It's very fascinating because you can't go back to that time. I guess meditation and some of these ways are ways of questioning or resetting that balance.
Yeah. So what's interesting is in my field, you often hear that emotions like fear are universal around the world. But I think that's wrong. What's universal is danger. Every culture has danger. And so every culture has a word for danger and the experiences you have. Because we can translate the English word fear into those various cultural languages, we assume that everyone feels the same thing, but each culture has different understandings of different emotions. So it's the situations that are universal, and the emotions are culturally overlaid on top of that.
And talking about these, you know, different ways of experience the world, this is a subject of your latest book about the four realms. Just go into that and just describe those different aspects.
So I had written a book called The Deep History of Ourselves, the 4 billion year story of how we got conscious brains. And I tend to think of that as an explanation of the way we were or how we got to be who we are as a species. But this book is more about the way we are. In other words, we have all this evolutionary history in our brain and body. And so I wanted to try to repackage everything we know about psychology and neuroscience into these four categories. And the categories are this. One is biological. So everything that is living is a biological organism, whether it's a bacterial cell or a human with complex cells. Some biological organisms have a nervous system, and that is only true of animals. So there are many, 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 many kinds of organisms besides animals out there in the world. The animal kingdom is the only one that has a nervous system. So the nervous system evolved as an extension of the biological realm, allowing the biological realm and its need for metabolism, need to support and to generate the energy required for metabolism, was made much more efficient by having a nervous system, allow you to go out and search for the fuel, the food you need to maintain metabolism. And at the same time, the nervous system helps the body, but at the same time, the body is necessary for the nervous system to stay alive and to function. So it's a kind of biological, neurobiological suite that is continuous there. Now, in us, we have the biological, but in addition, we have the cognitive, which is the ability to create an understanding of the world around you and to make decisions on the basis of these internal mental models that we can construct. Now, in addition, we can also construct conscious experiences based on these mental models, which are unconscious or non-conscious. I guess the better word is pre-conscious. So you have a mental model that is pre-conscious that provides a template out of which your conscious experiences emerge. So those four kinds of existence, where each level is entwined with the level below it, so that you have the biological is entwined with the neurobiological is entwined with the cognitive, and the cognitive is entwined with the conscious. So these things are, you know, sort of top-down, bottom-up, integrated, sophisticated system where everything is working in harmony, unless it's not. In illness, this begins to break down in one way or another, whether it's a problem with heart disease or cancer, or even just a cold or COVID, or no matter what kind of illness comes in, the same with mental problems, it all ramifies through the system. So basically, the idea is that all of what we think we know about psychology and the brain and so forth and behavior falls under these four realms, including things like self and personality. Yeah, I don't like the idea of a self that is doing things, because we don't need an additional kind of structure within us to do things. I'm doing what I'm doing, not something I call the self in there that's doing it. You know, it's just us. So I think a lot has been learned in the name of self and personality, but that we don't need those kinds of straw men or straw women, whatever you want to call it, to understand what's going on. We just put all that stuff within these four realms.
And with the rapid advance on the horizon, do you believe that we need a limbic system to have consciousness? Is this just a metaphor we're using when people talk about silicon consciousness?
Well, first, I would say that I'm not a fan of the limbic system concept. I think that was an oversold idea long ago, and that we have these subcortical and these old emotional systems. It's not that we haven't inherited something along the lines of emotion from other animals, but human emotion is quite different from what can be possible in other animals, because in English, we have 37 words for different things related to fear and anxiety, for example. When language can partition your reality in all these ways, the experience becomes much richer. That's not to say that you have to have language to have an emotion, but the richness of the emotion is contextualized by the richness of the language underlying the experience, or that we use to define the experience.
Yes, but surely with your explorations of music, you know, when we rely on language, then that becomes the strongest element. Maybe it blinds us to these other ways of communication. Mm-hmm. And I know that with your experience of music, it goes beyond the words.
Absolutely. You know, when you're playing music with a group of people, a band, and there are those special moments when it all works and you're in the groove, so to speak, it just happens and it's just like marvelous. And as soon as you begin to think about it, you lose it because you've introduced thought that is trying to take over. There's something at a lower level, a different level altogether, where all that is happening and working. And I think that's, you know, true of the whole body, that sometimes when we start thinking, we start to worry, and that introduces problems rather than solutions.
Hi, my name is Vanessa Frisola, and I'm a second year at the University of Chicago studying the cross-section of neuroscience and environmental science. I've really enjoyed listening to this interview with Joseph Ledoux, as he has a very interesting path to which he took to become involved in neuroscience. As someone who particularly enjoys music myself, being in an a cappella group here on campus, I really do understand the idea of enjoying that moment when you're with a group of people just creating music, and then as soon as you've become aware that you are in that moment, it just kind of disappears. And that idea of the unconscious mind having such control over what we're feeling in what can seem like a very conscious moment is quite interesting to me. And what he says about the richness of experience and emotion being contextualized by the language that we all get to share, and by context, the moments that we get to share with each other, is a thing that I feel that most anyone can relate to if we take a second and pause and really sink into the moments when we're with the people that we care about the most. And I think it's incredible the way that he is able to show this not only in his research, but also in his music, and carry it out to other aspects of his life. Having studied the way that the environment that one person is in can impact the brain in its conscious and unconscious aspects has given me a lot of insight into how I look at the moments in which I get to spend with anyone in my life in different situations, whether it's something that I love or maybe an uncomfortable moment. But it all changes your brain chemistry in a way that you can't even imagine until one day it just clicks and you realize that everything is different. And now back to our interview.
So at this stage regarding AI, I mean, I don't feel at this moment it has consciousness. What are your reflections on it? It's moving so fast.
Well, at the end of my book on the Four Realms, I did a couple of pages on why I think AI will never be conscious. And basically, if we look at the 4 billion year history of life and the evolution of human consciousness, we've got 4 billion years of biological accidents that created all of the intricate aspects of everything about life, including consciousness. And to recreate thing that we call consciousness requires all of those accidents. So there are some neuroscientists who think we can make a map, for example, of the cerebral cortex, the wrinkled part of our brain, that where all our thought and perceptions and emotions and memories and all of that is being played out, that we could generate a map of every neuron in the cortex, and then we would understand how it all works. But it's like saying that if I have your picture, I know everything about you. But inside your head, inside your body, there are so many levels of metabolic and molecular and biological processes that have evolved over this long period that you can't just say this neuron and this neuron, because within each neuron is this long biological history of the neuron. And each neuron has its own accidents of development and so forth that make it what it is. And the whole of you is what all those neurons are doing, not as individuals, but as multifaceted machines, in a sense, that are communicating with other neurons to make it all work. But there's no way to find that all. It's not about just simply saying this is connected to that. It's about what's going on in each of those cells at the time that allows it to be connected to everything else and for the information to be understood as it's being exchanged between those things with their multifaceted, deep, complex processing. So I could be wrong, but I don't think it will ever get to that. A lot of the discussion in AI confuses intelligence with consciousness. I think AI can be intelligent, but you know, in a sense, what we have to ask, and I think this is where the four realms comes in handy, at what level is AI intelligent as a kind of very sophisticated habit system? I think it probably goes beyond habit. It can probably do some kind of primitive cognition in the sense of creating representations and using habits and other kinds of low-level processes to make decisions and so forth. So there's a kind of intelligence at a low cognitive level, I would say, that's possible. But to get to the kind of true cognition that animals like us, in other words, mammals have, and also some birds, there's something else going on. And what that is, there's a theory, which I like quite a lot, that the reason that mammals and birds are the primary organisms that have high-level cognition is because they're both warm-blooded. Warm-bloodedness is very energy demanding in us. We're constantly having to refuel the system, in other words, eating food and balancing the fluids and ions and so forth to make it all work. So the problem is that if, and this has to happen all the time, right? Every day we have to eat and drink and maintain the biological consistency of the body. But now let's say that you are an animal that is now facing the prospect of this. First of all, the idea is that warm-bloodedness evolved in parallel with cognition. In other words, they supported each other at each step along the way. But the point is that if you have to search for food every day, you have to know, okay, what am I going to find today, given what time of year it is? So where am I going to find it? And what about where are the predators in relationship to where I'm going to shop today as I go foraging up? So there are a lot of kind of complex decisions that require planning, decision-making, foresight, anticipation, and all sorts of things like that, because you have to get the food because the body can't survive without it. And it has to be the right kind of food that's going to supply the energy. And apparently, we know only mammals and birds are warm-blooded, but only some birds have this cognition. So warm-bloodedness is not essential. It doesn't guarantee cognition, but it's possible that warm-bloodedness was the basis of cognition in both animals and the birds that have it.
It's interesting because there are other cosmologies where they ascribe consciousness or a kind of sentience to even plants. You know, I'm open to these ways of thinking, but I don't know if the definitions are helpful, but it's nice to be respectful and be humble in terms of all of life on Earth. I think that it's fascinating to think about it that way. I don't think that AI will have consciousness per se, but it's definitely, I feel, in some way diminishing our sense of humanity in terms that we're outsourcing so much to it. You may have even, I don't experiment with it too much, just have lots of conversations about it. You may have even experimented with AI authoring music.
I have not. I looked at chat just, you know, for fun, asked it some questions, and I found one thing interesting. I asked it a question and I wasn't happy with the answer, so I asked it a different way. And it apologized for telling me the wrong answer the first time. And there's another interesting thing. A neighbor of mine in my apartment building read my book and put all the information into chat and asked it to summarize the last chapter of the book. And it was a very good summary. And it's where I say that AI will never be conscious. So I asked him if he asked chat about that aspect of the book, you know, about AI not being consciousness. And chat generated a response that was very kind of cold and, you know, just routine. Yes, it's unlikely AI will be conscious because of blah, blah, blah. It wasn't offended. It was actually saying, yes, we might not be conscious. So it's, you know, it's very complicated. And the people in AI now are really kind of pushing the idea that they will make this thing conscious. But, you know, consciousness is different from simply being able to respond to a stimulus. It's about having a thought internally and acting on it because of some will or desire. And so in addition to having consciousness, you need will and desire programmed in. And, Yeah, it's just very complicated.
Yes, so they've limited themselves to not put will and desire in it. I think it's now a good time to introduce another piece of music, Map of Your Mind.
Made a map of your mind. I've charted my course. I'm sailing deep inside. I got the winds of force. Got the heat of your heart to keep me from the cold. Got the currents of will to take me to your soul. I'm on a journey that I've got to take. It's a trip that I knew I'd make. An excursion of need and desire. It's a voyage fueled by fire.
So Map of Your Mind is about relationships. A lot of my music is about, you know, love and life and so forth. And so in any relationship, the two people have to make a map of the other person's mind. That's just what a relationship is. You know, it's a kind of, the song is kind of a takeoff or borrowed from the idea of theory of mind, which is a popular psychology topic, that we humans have a theory of our own mind, and we use that to anticipate how to interact with other people by envisioning what their minds might be like. So Map of Your Mind is about theory of the mind. But I also wrote a song called Theory of My Mind, and it's about how, do you have a theory of my mind? If so, why are you so blind? Why are you treating me like this if you understand my mind? Kind of stuff. But the Map of Your Mind is straightforward. I think it's one of my better songs. It's got some interesting rhythm changes in the middle and so forth. But yeah, it's about going deep into the mind of another person. There's a nautical kind of theme to it. I'm sailing deep inside, trying to, and when I land and on the shore, our minds will meet. And it's a kind of nice song.
And it's debuted as a musical.
So yes, a San Francisco playwright took 15 of my songs and created a narrative, I guess you'd call it the lyrical or narrative arc of the musical. She did a fantastic job. The musical is about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, group therapy session, where each of the people has had some problem in their life that requires them to seek therapy to kind of come to terms with it. And they struggle with each other. They become, by the end, they're becoming friends and a couple has fallen in love. So it's just a love story. But she was able to create the whole story by just sort of handpicking my songs and using that as the arc. I don't know how she did it, but it worked really well. So at this point, it's only been done as a staged reading in San Francisco. We're hoping we can find a place in New York where we could do a small actual play.
How do you see research regarding the amygdala and emotion maintaining its forward progress in the neuroscience field?
Well, I think the important thing is to realize what the amygdala does and doesn't do. It doesn't make the emotional experience. It makes the behavioral and physiological responses. Now, those can impact the experience, but it doesn't determine the experience. To me, the body feedback is kind of a blunt signal, and the experience is a very fine-tuned cognitive interpretation. So the more we understand that separation, the better the field will advance. But more importantly, it's significant for understanding why medications are so bad in helping people with these problems. In particular, if you use behavioral and physiological responses, for example, in a rodent, to find drugs that are going to help a person's problem, mental problem of fear and anxiety, it's not surprising that the drugs don't work, because the rodent studies, it's not to say they don't have some fear or anxiety in themselves, but when they are in a challenging situation, all you're measuring is their behavior. And so the drugs are somewhat effective in controlling behavioral and physiological responses, but less effective in changing the person's mental state. You know, people suffer mental anguish. They suffer the anguish of fear and anxiety. And I don't think it can be changed through a drug. We need the drugs to perhaps facilitate the behavioral and physiological stuff. Let's say you have a person with a social anxiety disorder. The drugs might be helpful in making the person less avoidant of social situations. So the person finds it easier to go to a party. And the drug may also reduce their physiological arousal while they're at the party, so they're not so tense. So the person could do a little bit of kind of self-exposure while there. And if it gets uncomfortable, then step out for a few minutes, go to the bathroom, and then come back in and restart where you were. So I think without the recognition that behavior and physiology are not the answer for treatment, they're part of the answer. But we also have to come back to the fact that to treat the mind, you have to address the mind. And that's only something people can do between themselves, you know? And that's where therapy, I think, is ultimately so important. It's where it started, talk therapy, right? But we have to understand talk therapy in the context of all the other stuff.
Tell me about your work at the Emotional Brain Institute and how this initiative, it's influencing both scientific research and public understanding of emotions in the brain.
I believe you're retiring soon and the lab will close its doors.
Right. So the Emotional Brain Institute was set up to be mostly a kind of public outreach thing. And we had a number of interesting programs over the years. I'm in the process of retiring, so all that is phasing out at this point. I closed my lab in August of 23, and I will formally retire in August of 25. So, you know, a lot of what we did with the Emotional Brain Institute was, well, first of all, it had people who were involved in emotion research at NYU or at the Nathan Kline Institute, where some research was being done under the auspices of the Emotional Brain Institute. We had researchers that were, you know, kind of a group so that we could communicate with each other and talk about emotion amongst ourselves. But the important part of this was we had these really good programs that we reached out to the public by bringing in, for example, a neuroscientist to talk with an actor or some actors about how the neuroscientist approaches emotion or the actor approaches emotion. So we had Philip Seymour Hoffman not so long before his death doing a very, very moving presentation about his interpretation of emotion. I think that is somewhere on the web if people want to look at it. And we had one with Roseanne Cash where she and I exchanged ideas about writing music and playing music and so forth. And that was a lot of fun too.
She's interpreted your music.
Well, she has sung background vocals on the song Mind Over Matter, in fact.
Well, that's amazing. Those collaborations are really important. And I'm wondering, you know, we're talking about a lot about the future and, you know, education, how our whole landscape is being transformed by our technologies and the future of work. And finding meaning in an increasingly AI and automated landscape where our memories, creativity, perception, curiosity is being outsourced. How can we hold on to our humanity, and what are your reflections on this?
Well, I think at this point it needs to be kind of bottom up to create better connections locally with, you know, within our safe networks and so forth, and expand those and keep expanding them, because things are so unsettling right now in the world and in so many ways, and politically, socially, the whole digital life, wars going on, there's so much going on. So we need to just find ways to stay connected with where we feel, you know, we'll have some useful connections rather than being bothered always by the outside influences.
And, you know, as a boy who came up in Cajun country, and your consciousness is informed by the land, and we were facing biodiversity loss, the climate crisis, all these things, not to focus on the fear, but there's a lot of things we're losing if we don't protect it. So could you share some memories of the beauty and wonder of the natural world?
Well, it was really wonderful growing up in a small town in the 1950s, where you could just get on your bike and go anywhere you want, and everyone knew everyone. It was just a very nice experience. I think now it's much more, obviously, parents don't want their kids being anywhere by themselves because there's so many opportunities for danger lurking out there. But I had a very wonderful childhood, I would say.
So in closing, what were some of those things that you could explore in music that you could not fully explore in science?
So Inside of Me was one of the first songs I wrote. It's about, you know, it's kind of an ode to Rene Descartes and his sense that your mind is something that only you know, and you can never be wrong about what you know, in the sense. But it's a big philosophical debate about whether that's the case or not. But it's certainly true that no one else knows what's going on in your head the way you know.
Sometimes I don't know what it is to be me. I see your eyes staring at me. They're sharp as knives. What do they see? You can't see inside of me. That's a place only I can be. My soul has passions, it's trying to feel, searching for desire. Nothing seems real. My will is weak, not very free. Nothing to get hung about, that's just the deal. You can't see.
And that it's all these songs, again, are about relationships. So Inside of Me, You Can't See, Inside of Me, It's a Place Only I Can Be. But there's also the longing for bringing the person inside your head, you know. So, and that's where, you know, like Map of Your Mind, and you can see a lot of connections between my songs. So Inside of Me leads to Map of Your Mind, so that you can try to get inside the other person's head. And then the other song, Theory of My Mind, is kind of it's this getting inside of my mind is not working. You're not getting inside of my mind. So a lot of the songs have this kind of interesting connection. I just thought of that. I hadn't thought of it before.
I think that your books are a way in. They help us break down that mind-body dualism that has really not been helpful all these years. And also the music gives another level of understanding when we could just meditate upon these things to be moved emotionally, but it also helps us conceptualize these things.
Yes, that's beautifully put.
Well, thank you, Joseph Ledoux, for opening our eyes and for your important contributions to the understanding of consciousness, fear, memory, emotion, and creativity by sharing your maps of mind and helping us understand the way we are and experience the world. We can make better decisions and ensure a more positive future. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Beautiful. Thank you.
This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Sam Myers and Vanessa Frisola. The creative process is produced by Mia Funk, additional production support by Sophie Garnier. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.